Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and you are listening to the All Ball Podcast. Our guest in this version is Roger Powell Jr., who is an incredible coach. He just took a job with Gonzaga. Last 3 years, he's been at Vanderbilt. Previous to that, he was with Bryce Drew at Valparaiso. And, of course, you may remember him as one of the stars of the Illinois team that went 37-2 and lost the national championship game in 2005. He traveled all over the world to play basketball. He's played for an unbelievable list of coaches. He's coached under a guy who he deems to be one of the great offensive coaches in basketball. And he has his dad was a great player in his own right, and he kind of followed in his footsteps, albeit at Illinois as opposed to Illinois State. So he's got a great journey, and we'll talk about that. Let me quickly give you my thoughts on this, what I think is a controversy in regards to what's called by some the Rich Paul rule. As you know, the NCAA made basically a baseline for what you have to have if you want to recruit kids, sign kids on campus that are underclassmen. Got to have a bachelor's degree, got to be a member of the NBA PAs, got to be a cleared agent for like 3 years, and you got to go in and meet with the NCAA so you know their rules. None of these are tall asks. They're just not. It's not. I mean, personally, if I have an agent, I would actually like for him to have be a lawyer, you know, have a law degree, let alone a bachelor's degree. Of course, I want him to have experience in the league. Otherwise, the hell is he talking about? How does he know where I'm going to be drafted? And the idea of going to meet with the NCAA sounds like some draconian storyline or rule. But I mean, the fact is that if you're a member of the NBA PA, you have to know the rules of the NBA, but you don't necessarily have to know the rules of college basketball. By going to meet with the NCAA, you do. So you can't say, hey, I didn't know I wasn't supposed to do that. Right? You can't. And then you have LeBron James chiming in saying this is the Rich Paul rule. Look, LeBron James is obviously a narcissist, somebody with a narcissistic personality disorder characterized by grandiosity. Come on, the king. Excessive need for admiration, a personal disdain, lack of empathy for other. Displays arrogance and distorted sense of superiority. They seek to establish abusive and control of others, self-confidence. I think that he thinks, and this is a big one, self-perception of being unique, superior, and associated with high-status people and institutions. LeBron James is one of the all-time great players. But the NCAA isn't worrying themselves with one Rich Paul who might sign a guy or two from the NBA draft. They're concerned with the idea of guys that are underqualifying, misrepresenting themselves as qualified NBA agents, giving guys advice, which is bad advice. Because that's what happened. How many guys you seen stay in the draft because they thought they were told late first, early second? Like, well, you know, this thing happened, that thing. The best agents, they give really good advice. Do you know why? Because if you go lower in the draft than they told you to go, or if you go undrafted, most people usually fire their agent. That's what happens. Guys that go undrafted almost all fire their first agent. Many second round picks fire their first agent. Because they thought late first, early second. You go late second round or you go undrafted, you're going to fire that agent. So a real reputable agent isn't going to lie to you. This is a very low bar. So the bar is pretty low. And the newsflash to LeBron and all of his minions in the media and on social media is this isn't about Rich Paul. Rich Paul reps a guy or two in the draft. No, yeah, by the way, the idea that Rich Paul is the reason for an NCAA rule is when you think way too highly and you put way too much importance on yourself, which is kind of what LeBron has done in his narcissistic ways. He's not the first one to show player mobility. LeBron James changed teams twice, both times when he was a free agent. He didn't force his way out. Paul George, if anything, has forced his way out in a harder situation, signing and being traded 1 year later. Like, that's a bigger thing in the NBA than what LeBron has done. LeBron's a great player. He's done some interesting things. And he's helped raise Rich Paul to prominence. The only trailblazing he's done is for Rich Paul. Right? Is for Rich Paul. and that he's paved the way for a guy who was selling jerseys at the back of his car to being a prominent and powerful agent in the NBA. But for colleges to want to protect their student athletes and say, hey, just got to make sure a guy has a bachelor's degree, he's been a legit agent, met with us so he knows the rules, that's not a high bar. There's no more narcissistic statement than one that applies to all agents, and assuming it only applies to your agent. You know, look, if you combined it with what David Griffin said to Sports Illustrated, you start to see why everything David Griffin said, no matter how lightly he walked it back, does appear to be accurate. Right? It does appear to be accurate. From this perspective, LeBron himself has said he's not the same animal about winning. He's just said it in a different way. I have nothing more to prove in the NBA. If you think the culture that LeBron James brings to a team is good, then why did that thing fall apart so badly last year? Why did Kyrie Irving want out? Like, part of culture is, do the younger players get better? Does the team get better as the season goes on? Do they practice? The reason the Cavs were bad his last year in the regular season, they didn't practice. You can't establish culture. Can't refine offense. That's a really hard deal. Let's just go out and wing it. Figure it out on the fly. And he felt unhappiness. And I don't think Magic's unhappiness was solely based upon LeBron James. But the first thing Magic Johnson said when he resigned was, I want to be happy and be Magic Johnson again. So this is who LeBron is. Super talented. Unbelievable presence. Takes up the air in the room. But he's a narcissist who's never been told no, thinks so highly of himself, he thinks that he invented barbershop talk on television, even though there was actually a movie called The Barbershop, and there was a famous barbershop scene in Coming to America. Joe Louis was 72 years old, right? So while talented, David Griffin painted this picture that we know. He loves to play. At the end of the day, he'll compete and win, but he's not the same as he used to be. And it's not always that fun because it's not about building. It's just about creating a team that he can ultimately win with, take the credit when they win, and not take the blame when they lose. And now apparently the same goes for his agent and friend, Rich Paul, which is he thinks everything is about him, including an NCAA rule that literally has nothing to do with him or very little to do with him.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
During my lifetime, I think there's probably, let's see, I'm 43. And so there's moments that you remember about the Final Four. There's special teams that are unique. And one of those teams was the Fighting Illini. That was an incredible team. They were the first team when they lost North Carolina. It was a 2005 national championship game in St. Louis. I remember it because it was the first time I was actually sent to cover, which is kind of cool. And I was sitting courtside next to Michelle Beadle. That was the first time I met her. And I said before the game, she's like, does Illinois have any chance? And I was like, yeah, if they take like 43s, they got a good shot. And sure enough, they took 43s and nearly won the game. And that team was really transformative in college basketball. One of the stars of that team is now an assistant coach at Gonzaga. His name's Roger Powell. He joins us in the All Ball podcast. Roger, how are you?
I'm doing good. How about yourself, Doug?
Good. I want to get to that Fighting Illini team. I want to talk about your post-Illinois playing career. Okay? But you're from J-Town. So, look, here's what I know about Joliet, Illinois. Okay, I'll give you the short, quick version. My teammate at Notre Dame was named, Bell.
Gary Bell.
Gary Bell. Okay, G. Bell. Right?
Yeah.
And Gary Bell was listed, I believe, at like 6'8", and he was at best 6'5". But in today's NBA, he would be nasty because he was like an undersized four, left-handed, long arms, whatever. But I rolled up to the Coca-Cola All-American game my senior year in high school, and I walked in the gym, and they set it up as in Indianapolis at the time. It was run by Bob Knight's son, And I remember, like, I was excited because I'd signed to play at Notre Dame, and Gary Bell was actually the highest-rated recruit. And I was like, where's Gary Bell? Like, right there. I was like, no. That guy's, like, 6'4". Like, that's Gary Bell. Anyway, and then, yeah, so that's my first Joliet memory. What was it like growing up in Joliet, Illinois?
Oh, man, Joliet. Well, it's funny you mentioned Gary Bell. You know, he was definitely one of those guys that I grew up in junior high watching play. And, you know, Joliet is a suburb of Chicago, you know, about 40 minutes away. So, you know, you kind of have your own, you know, Joliet swag, you know, because we go up to Chicago, you play against, you know, the Whitney Youngs, the Julians. You know, we always in Joliet, we always had a chip on our shoulder. But with that being said, we have some really talented players, you know, in the, you know, suburb area. So growing up there, man, you know, it's just, you know, it was just a form of pride and a form of, you know, just trying to, you know, carry on a legacy, you know, of all the good basketball players that came from Joliet. You know, my dad being one of them, you know, Gary Bell, Ty Calderwood, who played at Wisconsin, you know, John Ford, you know, David Evans. You know, so
Terry Gannon was from Joliet. He played Joliet Catholic as well. Tell me about your dad. Your dad was a great player at Joliet Central. What do you know about his career, about how he played?
So my dad, obviously he was from Joliet, played at Central. I played at West. There are two schools that are separated from, like, you know, like 2 miles, West Side. East Side's kind of like the rough part of Joliet. I kind of grew up in that area, but then I moved to the West Side when I was in eighth grade to get away from gangs and get away from a lot of the bad things that were going on. So, you know, growing up, you know, all I could do was just hear stories about my dad at Central, man, who, you know, broke records. I mean, as a sophomore, he averaged like 33 points a game in high school. And, you know, so he was a really good, you know, basketball player, kind of like a legend in the Joliet area. So, you know, obviously I had a lot of, you know, large shoes to fill. Then he went to Illinois State and played for the Redbirds. And his nickname was the Mad Bomber because he could really shoot from far out. Like, he had deep range. And, you know, everyone was just like, every time, you know, my dad comes up, you know, like, man, that guy can really, really shoot. So he was, you know, an All-American there, played with Doug Collins. And then after that, he went on and had some trials with some NBA. And he decided to be a teacher at a maximum security prison. He coached a little bit at Joliet Junior College, so to keep kind of basketball, keep his basketball fix going. So, you know, that's my dad in a nutshell. But it's amazing everywhere I go. I mean, I've been coaching for 9 years now. It's my ninth year. And, like, every time I meet somebody, someone has a story about my dad, which is really cool to hear.
Yeah, and you know, my dad's no longer here. My dad was, you know, he was obviously not a player. Like, he played, but not a player like your dad. But it's one of the things about basketball kind of being this family. I remember late Howard Garfinkel said that to me. Like, every year I'd see him at the Final Four. It's like, you know, your dad, he brought your mom up. She was his fiance. Basketball is family. And it really is. And then when they say great things about your parents, it's pretty awe-inspiring. So when you're coming up, at that time, he's working at a maximum security prison while you're a kid?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, he was working. He was a PE teacher at a maximum security prison, and it was a youth prison, IYC Joliet. And you know, the oldest kids there were 18, so it's teenagers and you know, guys that, you know, did, you know, bad crimes. I mean, it was pretty intense. But the cool thing was, you know, every once in a while I would get to go and play pickup basketball with those guys. You know, so here I am, a junior high kid, you know, playing pickup with a bunch of inmates. And that's kind of where, you know, I kind of got my toughness, kind of got my swagger from those opportunities. And then, you know, sometimes my dad would take me there to help me, you know, refocus and not get in trouble, man. Because, like, I kind of grew up and I was kind of a problem child. Like, I got kicked out of, like, 4 schools, you know, 1 school twice, you know, in my elementary year. So
wait, what'd you do?
He would often bring me there.
What'd you do?
Oh, my goodness, I did some of everything, man.
Like what?
So I grew up, obviously, Joliet, East Side. I had some really, my family members were all kind of like gang members. And, you know, I kind of had a chip on my shoulder because, like, I was one of the only kids in the neighborhood that had a dad. So I would always, you know, you just act out, do things, and get in fights. And I don't know, just childish things that was kind of useless. And, you know, I ended up getting kicked out. But to be honest, I went to a Catholic school in junior high, and that kind of changed my life, man. You know, that's where I kind of refocused. I got serious on my academics and basketball. I got even better, and it kind of gave me a goal, and it just kind of helped me, you know, helped me refocus and, you know, stop getting in trouble.
That's crazy. So I never got kicked out, but, I mean, I got in trouble all the time. Like, you name it, I did it, right? Like, when I was in middle school, my dad was like, hey, I'm going to hold you back because he grew late. He knew I was going to grow late. I was like 5 feet tall in eighth grade, 203 pounds. And so, like, I knew I was I was just a pain in the ass. So, like, I did things where I took a paper clip and have a rubber band and I'd fire it. A substitute teacher, you know, wouldn't be looking, I'd fire it, and I actually hit one of them in the face, got suspended. And then my grades came, and it used to be it was one of those where it would come in, and it was like a self-contained envelope, and you'd open it up, and it was that deal where it was like you could actually erase them really quickly, and I erased them and knew how to make it look, use a typewriter, and type on the back where it had that kind of paper that would make the print and change the grades. So, and I didn't give myself like straight A's, it was like A's and B's and maybe one C or something instead of like the D's and C's that I had. And so my mom goes in when I get suspended from school and she has to meet with the vice principal, and the vice principal's like, you know, and his grades are terrible. She's like, what are you talking about? I was like, yeah. She's like, he's failing some classes. He's not showing up. She's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. She's like, he's like, here's the report card. She's like, that's not the report card I got. And so, you know, like it was. So what, when you get in trouble at school, how would your dad handle it?
Oh, man. Talk about spankings, man. My dad wasn't, my dad didn't spare the rod, but shoot, it didn't work. You know, it's funny, man. I actually share this story a lot when I speak to kids. You know, I grew up obviously in a rough city. You know, I saw a lot that a kid shouldn't see. You know, it wasn't uncommon for us to be going home and a drive-by happened and we had to duck behind cars. So, like, you know, you just kind of, it's just the environment you're in. You know, you're mad and you feel like fighting is the only way to, you know, kind of, you know, achieve any type of, you know, man stamp, you know. So it was just kind of like a persona that I tried to take on. But the funny thing is, you know, the last school I got kicked out of, it was Eliza Kelly. And it was like one of the roughest schools in our area. And here I am getting kicked out of the roughest school. So my parents kind of had the last string. They would say, okay, we're either going to send you to a juvenile center or we're going to try a Catholic school. And the Catholic school was on the west side of Joliet, St. Jude's. And I'll never forget my first, like, week there. Like, I was the only black kid in the school. It was like each class had, like, 25 students in the whole class. And, you know, everyone was kind of intimidated by me. But, you know, it was my last shot, and my parents convinced the nuns and the principal that, hey, he's going to be on his best behavior. And, man, my first report card there, I got 4 Fs and a D. And I got a D in PE. And it was just, I was going down the tubes. It didn't look like it was going to work. And there was this lady named Miss Fink. And, like, I share this to everybody I speak to because it's a remarkable story how, you know, a teacher can really impact a kid. This lady, Miss Fink, kind of took me under her wings. Now, she was like 6'2". She was an intimidating teacher in the school. There were so many scary stories about her, but yet she took time to mentor me. And she just, you know, we had a couple conversations, and I can relate to her because I was tall and everybody was intimidated by me. And, you know, we just kind of hit it off. And she was like, if you think you want to be a basketball player, and if you think that, you know, you want to be successful and you want to, you know, have a good future, you're going to have to focus on your academics. You're going to have to learn to, you know, be respectful in classrooms and not fight when you get angry. And she basically, like, mentored me. And that lady, to this day, like, I give her credit for changing my life because I went from 4 Fs and 1 D to, you know, my sixth grade year or my seventh grade year, I was a BC student. Eighth grade year, A's and B's. And then my first year in high school, I was a straight A student, never getting kicked out of school. It just totally changed my life. So, you know, I went back to that school about, I want to say, 3 years ago, and I went to say hi to her, and they had a school assembly that day, and they were actually honoring her on the day I showed up, and I got to share that story, man. It was a pretty special moment, man. So, that's kind of how, you know, my life changed, and that's kind of the direction or the moment where, like, my life started to take a positive trend up, you know?
Bill Self is head coach at Illinois. You're in high school in Joliet. They started to get it rolling. What led you to pick Illinois?
You know, initially, like, they actually offered me, man, my freshman year in high school. I was playing varsity. We played downstate. We played against Quincy. And I think Rob Judson at the time was an assistant there. And he saw me in the state tournament. And, you know, my freshman year, that was my first offer. And it was actually when Lon Kruger was there. And, you know, I kind of fell in love with Illinois. You know, I always wanted to play for my state. But, you know, I was getting recruited by Michigan State, Tom Izzo, Arizona, some really good schools. Notre Dame was recruiting me really heavily. And, you know, I wanted to kind of go through the process a bit. But I always had Illinois in the back of my mind. So I committed early after my sophomore year. And then that's when Lon Kruger, actually, I think he left and went to the NBA.
Yeah.
And they hired Bill Self. And Bill Self came to see me, and he continued to recruit me. And we built a really good relationship, and you know, I stayed committed, and I signed with Bill Self.
How good were you your senior year?
You know, my senior year, I was good. I mean, I was like a top five in the state. I think I was like fourth for like runner up Mr. Basketball. But that year, you know, we had, you know, Eddie Curry, Will Bynum, myself, Najee Beckles, Pierre Pierce, Luther Head. So it was a very talented run in the Chicago suburbs and the city. You know, the year before us, you know, it was Dwayne Wade, you know, was there, Matt Loddick. So, I mean, basketball was really healthy in the Chicagoland area during those years.
So you show up at Illinois in 2001. Who was in your squad?
2001. Shoot, man.
I have it in front of me if you need help.
So the freshman, it was myself. Luther Head,
yep.
And then I think our seniors was Corey Bradford, Frank Williams, Robert Archibald, who played in the NBA.
Sure.
Obviously, everyone knows Frank Williams played in the league.
Brian Cook.
Demir Kupalia. Brian Cook was a junior.
Yep. Snacks.
Jarence Howard.
Yeah, Snacks was
there. Yep. Snacks. Yeah, we had a squad, man. It was family, too, man. It was a pretty cool deal.
Okay, so I do think it's interesting. Like, so Champaign is, like, for a guy you're from the suburbs of Chicago, like, it's a little bit out there, right? It's a true kind of state school, and it does. I always feel like, you know, when I went to Oklahoma State, it was different than Notre Dame in that it was a state school. It's removed kind of from a city, and so it brings you closer. Was that what it was like for you? Like, was it too country for you? Like, what was it like for you when you first got there?
Man, you know, it, to be honest, I didn't really think much about it. I was just excited to be playing for Illinois back in that day. I mean, Illinois had it rolling. You know, we were winning Big Ten championships. And obviously, you know, my 4 years there was pretty remarkable. We won the Big Ten every year and, you know, three Sweet 16 championship games. So, you know, when you're there, basketball was so exciting. You know, fans were loved us. You know, you kind of forget that you're in a cornfield in the middle of nowhere, because, you know, you're pretty much at the gym, your dorm, class, and then traveling for games. So it was fun, man. I love my 4 years there.
Why didn't Frank Williams make it in the league?
I have no idea, man. He was a really good talent, you know, and he was a great guy. Man, I really loved playing with him, you know, but. You know, it's the NBA is not easy.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that he got drafted and the fact that he played the games he did, you know, I think it's a success. Now, some guys, you know, obviously pan out and get in a good situation where they fit and things go well. And some guys, you know, maybe play for 3 or 4 years and shoot. I don't know too many basketball players that wouldn't trade that type of career for, you know.
No question, but he was super, super hyped. And he, you know, and he, Bill Self really got a lot more out of him than felt like Lon would. But then he didn't, you know, he didn't stick for a long time in the NBA. The next year you bring in James Augustine, Darren Williams, and D Brown. But I want to ask you about your freshman year. You didn't play very much. What was that like?
I didn't.
What was that like emotionally to go through? Your dad's a legend. You played every year in high school. You're a star. You come into Illinois and you barely play. What was that like?
Man, so, you know, I was pretty confident that I was going to be a starter there. You know, I knew that, you know, I had some guys ahead of me, some seniors that, you know, had a lot of experience. But, you know, I worked my tail off. And, you know, I was tough in practice. I didn't back down. And when I did play, you know, and I showed glimpses, I showed signs, you know, that, you know, I was going to be good. And the thing that changed my career was the summer going from my freshman to sophomore year.
Yep.
I went to a Big Ten All-Star trip, and Bill Self was actually the coach. And I actually led that team in scoring. And they said, I mean, they had a bunch of upperclassmen, Tom Coverdale. I mean, there was a ton of guys that played in the Big Ten that were older. And, you know, I really played really well. And all the work that I put in the summer of my freshman year, you know, during the season, the extra work I put in outside of practice, and then leading up to that Big Ten All-Star trip, the work I put in, it kind of came out. And I thought that was where Bill Self saw, you know, the potential I had. And he started me the next year. And, you know, I played really well. And, you know, obviously we went on to win the Big Ten tournament, and we went to the tournament, lost in the second round. But that my freshman to sophomore year was where I made the huge strides, and I never looked back.
I mentioned that freshman class that came in. That team that won the Big Ten that year, your only senior was Brian Cook, who was, again, kind of before his time, right? Like, you know, stretch 4-5. You know, James Augustine, mm-hmm. became kind of the same thing. But you brought in Darren Williams and D. Brown. And it's interesting because when D was probably more highly regarded, right? One, because he's from the state. Two, because he's just such an electric player. Did you know, mm-hmm. what did you see from Darren Williams when you first saw him?
I knew Darren was going to be really good. You know, number one, he could really, really defend. And he was extremely, extremely competitive. And, you know, he was a little overweight when he got there, so he needed to lose some weight. And but I knew he was going to be a special point guard. He had great court vision. And, man, I feel like, you know, he was that bigger guard that could guard anybody. And so as his freshman year went on, I mean, he just kept getting better. And, I mean, each year he improved a ton. But I knew he was going to be special. Now, I was shocked. I'm not going to lie. I was shocked that, you know, obviously he was an NBA All-Star. But, you know, I mean, the kid just kept improving. And he was just, you know, his competitive nature, I think, is a reason that he was, you know, as good as he was.
Okay, so Bill Self leaves, what, after that year?
After our sophomore year, yep, he took off.
So you guys go to the tournament. You lose to Notre Dame, right? You lost to Notre Dame in the NCAA tournament in the second round. You beat Western Kentucky, lose to Notre Dame. What do you remember about losing the game and when Bill ended up leaving and how you guys found out?
So it's funny because, you know, we lost to Kansas my freshman year in the Sweet 16, I believe. And, you know, like, no one ever really thought that Coach would leave and go to Kansas because, you know, I mean, it was like we were upset. And we wanted to play them again and beat them. You know, it was kind of like that. You know, if we see them dudes again, we're gonna beat them. And when he said he was leaving, you know, it was tough. It was really tough because we built a really good relationship. He believed in me. He gave me an opportunity. You know, my sophomore year to start me at the three position, which, you know, I love playing in the wing, and I really felt like I was getting a lot better. And so when he decided to leave, you know, we had to make a decision. Me personally, if I was going to transfer or stay. And I'm a loyal guy, so obviously I end up staying. And, you know, I believe our team, we all kind of came together and rallied together and said, we're going to stay. And when they hired Bruce Weber, you know, he just kind of came in and, you know, was able to, you know, get us to compete and get us to play together. We believed in him. And, shoot, that, you know, we went on a run from there. You know, I think he did a good job of, you know, getting us to believe in him, getting us to believe in his system, his style, and keeping that team together because, it, obviously, you know, we were a special team. And if any one of us would have left, you know, I don't think we would have been as good because we were so good together.
Where did you almost go? Did you follow him? Were you going to follow him to Kansas? Where were you going to go?
I don't even remember at the time. You know, I thought about that, but, you know, I was really comfortable with Illinois. And then, you know, one thought was my dad played at Illinois State and he was an All-American there, and maybe going to Illinois State could have been, you know, cool, you know, going down to a mid-major. And maybe I could have had a big role there and all my dad's legacy. But, you know, I decided to stay, and I'm really happy I did, because I mean, my junior senior year, I thought my freshman sophomore year was good. My junior senior year, man, we really won a lot of games and had a ton of success.
Okay, but you also played the four, right? So you said how much you liked playing the three, and Bill started you at the three. What was the conversation like with you and Bruce Weber when he said, look, you know, we could put Augustine at the five. We got you, D. Will, D. Brown, Luther Head. Those are three guards. You know, we played small when I was in college. We had Desmond Mason play the four. So it wasn't like you were the first of the kind, but I'm guessing that because, you know, look, in the league, there weren't 6'6", four men back then, right? They just weren't.
Yeah.
What was that conversation like?
You know, it's funny because my junior year, I still started at the three. And, you know, I think Luther Head came off the bench. And it was me,
Brian
D,
Randall,
Darren, and
Nick Smith, maybe? Did Nick Smith start center? Yeah.
I forget. Maybe Brian Cook was Brian Cook on that team?
No.
Year?
No. Brian Cook graduated your. Come on, man. I'm looking at the stats. Yeah, I'm looking at the stats right now.
Before. I know James Augustine started the five, and there's one other player that started our junior year.
Hold up, I got the Nick Smith started six games. Brian Randall started nine games.
Okay,
and Luther started 24 games, but he only played.
Yeah,
29.
So it'd be, I started out playing the three, and then he brought me in, and he asked, "Hey, would you be willing to go down to the four?" Because he felt like it'd make our team more, you know, versatile. And obviously he knew that I wanted to be a wing. And, you know, obviously I worked on a lot of guard skills, and he was just like, he knew that from a standpoint of, you know, getting drafted, you know, I could think it could hurt my draft status, which it may have very well did, but you know, I knew and Coach Weber knew, you know, me playing the four would pose a mismatch for other teams. And I was strong enough. I was, you know, big enough. I was athletic enough to do it, and so I said, "Sure, I'll do it for the team." And it ended up really helping us. I mean, I know, like in the Big Ten play, we won like 13 straight games to finish out the season, and then obviously our senior year, we were 29-1 in the regular season. So, you know, it was one of those things where, like, I believed in what he was saying, and you know, me going down to the four, I still was starting. I thought it could help our team, and it did. So that was the conversation. And you know, I don't regret it because, I mean, we could literally switch one through four, and it just made us more versatile.
You guys were 26-6. You take on Duke in the NCAA tournament. They have Luol Deng, JJ, Daniel Ewing, Duhon, Sheldon Williams, Shavlik Randolph, and it was a close game at half. And they end up beating you by 10. What do you remember about losing to Duke?
It was a tough game. You know, it was a tough game to lose. I really wanted to beat those guys. I really wanted to advance. But at the same time, it was fun. You know, I don't know. I think in the game, I played one of my better games. I think I had like 18 points and like 8 rebounds. And I was matched up against Luol Deng, someone that was I knew was going to be a first-round draft pick. So for me, I took it as an opportunity to, you know, prove that, you know, I was an NBA player. And, but we came up short. I mean, they were really good, really good. And, you know, I think losing that game kind of put a chip on our shoulders going into the summer, you know, for the following season. But you know, it was a fun game. Anytime you play in a Sweet 16, you know, you play in those atmospheres, those environments, it's special.
Okay, so you win 29 in a row to start your senior year. You win every game of the regular season, only to lose the regular season finale, right? To go 30-0, you play at Ohio State, you lose by 1 point. Here's the question that matters 15 years later. Do you remember the other game, any of the other games, or do you just remember the loss to Ohio State?
It's crazy because like, I definitely remember the loss to Ohio State more than a lot of the other games. But with that being said, like I remember, you know, playing Wake Forest, you know, when they were number one and we were number three. In Assembly Hall, and we beat them by like 20 points. I remember, you know, some of the Wisconsin games, because back then, Wisconsin, we had a huge rivalry. And one of my buddies who played at Lockport, which is a cross-town rival, Alondo Tucker, played at Wisconsin. So, you know, that was always a special game for me because, you know.
You guys smoked them twice.
Illinois versus Wisconsin was like Joliet Township versus Lockport. You know, yeah. It was kind of one of those, like, rivalries. So that was the memorable games. But definitely, you know, you remember that, you know, Matt Sylvester going nuts. He wasn't even, like, a major part of our scouting report, but the dude had, like, 27 points and, like, just totally, like, destroyed us. And, but at the end of the day, I felt like it kind of refocused us. Because we went to a tournament with 30-0, you know, I don't know if we would have ran off those, you know, 8 straight games to get to the championship.
Okay, so you win the Big Ten. You win the Big Ten tournament. You beat Wisconsin a third time. You go to the NCAA tournament. And you get to the Elite Eight, chance to go to the Final Four. And you guys were down, the famous Illinois comeback. Were you guys down like 14 with how many minutes to go? Like that thing was, it felt like it was over, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, people turned the TV off. You know, people were upset. Our fans were quiet. No, it was an unbelievable comeback. And, you know, I still to this day don't even know how we made it, man. I remember in the game praying and saying, God, I guess it's not meant for this to happen. But I said, if it is, you got to help us. And that's where we were down 14. Like, I remember praying that prayer. Yeah. And then we got still, hit a three, got another still, hit a three. I think we got another still, hit a three, and just like, bam, like, the game is tied. And I just knew once we tied the game, I knew we were winning in overtime. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, you're down, I believe you're actually down 15 with 4 minutes to go. It was at Allstate Arena, which, of course, that's where DePaul used to play. It used to be the Rosemont Horizon, right? So it's in the suburbs of Chicago. And you're literally, you know, you guys have arguably the greatest comeback in the history of Illinois. And then you go to overtime. Like, look, it was close. As much as you may have said, hey, coming back, tying it, we knew. They still forced overtime, and it was still a close game in overtime.
It was. It really was. It really was. But I just was confident we were going to win. And that team was good, man. They had Von Adams, Shannon Fry. Who else did they have? They had a lot of really good players.
No, Channing Fry was legit. Here, I'll give you their lineup. Salim Stoudemire, Mustafa Shakur, Hassan, yeah. Adams, Channing Frye, he give you 24 and 12. Was that he was guarding? Is that who you were guarding?
I guarded him a little bit, but hold on. I had 18 and like 9. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, like it was.
I mean, listen, Channing Frye gave it to you. It's okay. Like, Channing Frye has given it to a lot of people. He gave it to you a little bit there, but
no, actually, he gave it to. I'm just joking.
To James Augustine.
But James Augustine was matched up with him. I was matched up with their four man.
Radinovich. Yeah. Ivan Radinovich.
I mean, he scored that game.
Yeah, you guard the big white stiff. That's what you do. You're like, man, give me the stiff. He had 14. I believe that's a career high, by the way. He had 14, four steals, two assists, five rebounds. It's actually his resume tape is lighting you up.
What was my stat line?
You want your stat line? Were 6 of 11. You had 16 points, five rebounds. Four offensive boards. That's big, big five. One block, one turnover.
One defensive rebound. I was trying to get put back.
Yeah, and you had four offensive fouls. Four fouls, not four offensive, but four fouls.
Four fouls.
Yeah. James Augustine fouled out.
What else did I have? I had the big what? The W, right?
You had the W. You had zero assists, I want to point out. Complete selfishness.
I didn't have to pass. We had 3 point guards on the court.
So you go to the Final Four. So, like, look, you go from playing in Chicago, hometown, not far, playing in St. Louis. And I think everyone knew, like, you guys were on a, or I felt like, I remember covering it, you guys were on a collision course to play against North Carolina. You guys stomped Louisville. I mean, you beat the heck out of Louisville in the semifinals. And then you take on North Carolina, and here you guys are 37-1. You know, you're 37-1. The only loss is by 1 point, and yet you guys were big-time underdogs to North Carolina. What do you remember about preparing for the national championship game?
Man, it goes so fast. I mean, when you think about the Final Four, just I remember getting there and they have that Final Four ceremony where you get your ring and they get that little watch. I mean, it's just it's just a surreal moment. And to be honest, I don't really remember a ton of the preparation just because it's going so fast and there's so much excitement. But the one thing I do remember, now this might be weird, there's one moment in every game, in college, professionals, that it makes me feel special. Like, it makes me feel like I am a part of this. I am a part of this event, this athletic event. I am in this game. I'm about to perform. Like, and that's the national anthem. Like, every time I play, every time the national anthem, even as a coach, like, it's just, it's that moment where, like, I take in the environment, I take in the fans, I take in the moment. And I remember the national anthem in St. Louis, and I think it was the Rams, and I forget the name of the dome, but I remember they had an eagle fly from the top of the dome and land at half court. And I remember just, like, you know, the singing of the national anthem, and just that moment, man, was the time where I can really just take in, we are in the national championship game. And once it tipped, and once we started playing, I mean, you're just so focused on trying to win. You know, there's really nothing else distracting you. But, like, the national anthem at the championship game is where, like, I kind of took in the moment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was amazing. And you guys took 40 threes. You only made 12 of them. Game was close. You end up losing by 5 points. I distinctly remember that locker room. We lost in the Elite Eight in Syracuse to Florida in 2000. And I'll never forget, like, looking around that locker room, and it like you mentioned, it goes so fast. Like, you played 4 years at Illinois. You started for three of those years, and you guys won 4 Big Ten championships. Like, you won a lot of ball games. And then all of a sudden, like, then it's over. It's like, I will probably never play with these guys ever again. And as you know, there's an incredible bond when you play in college, especially, you know, as you said, surrounded by cornfields, whatever. Dudes are from all over, and you come together, and it's like your family. Do you remember that? Do you remember what Bruce said when it was over? Do you remember anything about that locker room?
You know, I don't. I mean, obviously, I cried, man. You know, just the hardest thing. And I hate that this has to happen, but the hardest thing is coming up second, you know, in the national championship game. Like, that's the hardest thing to endure, because you're walking off the court, and there's a celebration going on, and you're not celebrating. And it's funny because, like, now as a basketball coach in college, like, I go to the Final Fours every year, and I love going to the games, the championship game, the semifinals game, and I can always relate to the team that loses as they're walking off the court, because, like, that is, like, you have this high of getting to the moment, and then, bam, you come up short. It's hard. It's hard. But, you know, obviously, you're in the locker room, you know, it's just like, man, I feel like I think I remember Coach Weber was very positive, and, you know, just, like, really praised us for accomplishing what we did. Was like, it's an unbelievable accomplishment to make it that far.
You know,
and, you know, it kind of helped cheer us up a little bit, but it stunk.
No, and look, you guys went small and they were big, and Sean May kicked James Augustine's ass, right? And you guys tried to, you did the math, you did almost analytics. Three is about more than two. You guys were down big at the half. You came back, made it super close, but you just couldn't make enough shots, you know, to win the game. Luther had 5 of 16, you know, but, I mean, the big thing was you guys could not contain Sean May. He just kind of ate you guys alive. It was my memory of it. Is that an accurate depiction?
Yeah, you know, James Augustine fouls out in 10 minutes. I mean, that was kind of, to be honest, it was kind of ridiculous. You know, I just, you know, it was unbelievable how a guy can foul out in 10 minutes, you know, so... You know, I know Sean May was really good, and I'm not taking anything away from him.
Right.
You know, I mean, James Augustine should play more than 10 minutes in that game. That would have helped us a ton. And, you know, you just, you know, they made some big-time shots. And, you know, it was a good game, you know. And obviously, we shot a lot of threes, and, you know, if some of those threes will fail, you know, it's a
different
different game.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, like I said, even to this day, man, when I see guys from North Carolina, man, it's just we, you know, we got to experience that, you know. You know, Jackie Manuel, I see him a ton. He coached at Valpo where I was for 5 years. So we kind of had a relationship from there. And, you know, it's just like, hey, man, this was still a cool thing that we got to experience. Those guys just came out on top.
So you get done playing. You go undrafted. What did you go? How did you? Did you go to summer league with the Sonics? How'd you get to? How'd you get with the Sonics?
Yeah, I actually went to summer league with. I go to summer league my first year. I kind of so long ago. I made it with the Dallas Mavericks, and then I signed with the Seattle SuperSonics. I went to training camp with them, and I made the preseason roster. And I was like the last cut, and then from there I went to the
NBA. Like, hold on, you're going too fast here, real quick. Okay, so the SuperSonics. Who was in that training camp?
Jeez, man, that's over 10 years ago,
bro.
Which is crazy.
You don't remember who was on? Jeez. Like, you walk into the Seattle SuperSonics. I mean, this is back when they were good. You want to know who's on that roster?
Ray Allen. Yeah, okay,
he was kind of nice. Like, Jesus was on the team. You got Jesus
Shuttlesworth,
right?
Which was awesome. Like, I got to spend a lot of time with him. That was great. He was awesome. Rick Brunson,
yes,
was on that team.
Yes.
And Rick Brunson was somebody that I kind of continued to build a relationship with. Luke Ridenour.
Yep.
We had some vets on that team, too.
Was Damian Wilkins was on that team, I think?
Damian Wilkins. Him and I were, like, competing for a spot, I believe. I don't think he was guaranteed.
Reggie Evans was on that team.
Yep. Reggie. Big Reggie. Iowa. Another Big Ten guy.
Vitaly Potapenko. They had Robert Swift was their first-round draft pick.
Yep. I remember him.
Did you know that he was, like, he couldn't handle it?
I didn't. I mean, it was just, like, I didn't at the time, but, you know, he was big and athletic.
Yep.
Crazy. And had a ton of tattoos at the time. Like, that was back when tattoos started becoming even more prevalent.
Yeah.
But I remember he had a ton. But the dude, man, he should have stuck. I don't know what happened with him mentally or whatever, but, like, man, he was talented.
So, do you remember getting cut?
Sucked. I try to block those moments out, Doug.
I'm here to bring them up. I'm here because I remember. So I was in training. I was in. I did the vet free agent camp with the Lakers three different times, and I remember every time. Mitch Kupchak would come in and go like, nah, you know, like, hey, you've been great, blah, blah. And the third time he was like, we feel like you're really close and you should probably go to the D League and you might have a shot at this thing. And I was a bad fit for their system. They were triangle, obviously, and I need a ball screen. You know, I need the ball in my hands, not out of my hands. I wasn't a shooter. And I remember what I remember most, and you ultimately obviously made it with the Jazz the next year, but what I remember most was you walk in the facility, and at the Lakers, you walk by Shaq's picture, Kobe's picture, Magic's picture, Kareem, Wilt, Jerry West, Goodrich, everything. And at first you're like overwhelmed, and then everybody's so cool to you and treats you like you're part of the team. They're like, yeah, I could do this. And then you start to like think about, because when I got there, I didn't think I was like, there's no way I'm making the Lakers, no shot. I need to impress other people. And then you're like, man, I could do this. And then they come in like, nah, you can't do this. I remember just that being devastating to me. I mean, if searching back in those negative memories, what do you remember about it?
Yeah, it was tough, man. It was tough. You know, I felt like I should have made the team, and I competed in practice. But, yeah, I was a rookie, and I knew that, you know, it was something that, you know, I had to grind harder than everybody else, and I did that. But I didn't get much of an opportunity in preseason. I didn't get much opportunity to play, so I kind of had a feeling that, you know, once the game started, I wasn't going to make it.
So you go to Rockford. You go back to Rockford. So now you pack your stuff, you get cut, you go to the CBA, and this is when the CBA is not the CBA of old, but you went in and you decided to play for a team kind of close to your hometown, like Rockford's not far from Joliet, and you were CBA Rookie of the Year. Why not go overseas? Why stay stateside?
I wanted to play in the NBA, and I was going to play in the NBA, you know, and that was something that I was determined to do, and I approved. So in the CBA, I got to play the three, and, you know, I got to handle the ball, I got to shoot threes, I got to, you know, create off the dribble, and, you know, it was good for me. You know, it was a good experience. It was great for my wife. We got married young, and we got to live not that far from my hometown, and so I feel like I was ready for an NBA roster, so that's why I didn't go overseas. And at the time, you know, I wouldn't have got probably a big contract overseas because, you know, I hadn't done much.
So that summer, you went to, did you work out in Utah? Like, how did it come to where you you went to camp with the Jazz?
So they had me come for a workout, and Mike, as soon as the CBA season was done, like, I came there and worked out by myself, and they tried to put me through the ringer, and I handled it, man. And they were impressed, and they ended up giving me like a partial guarantee to come to training camp. And it was them and the Miami Heat. I did workouts with both of them, the Miami Heat and the Jazz, and the Jazz guaranteed more money, so obviously, I went the Jazz route. Yeah, it was cool, man. I was there all summer. I trained with the team, and you know, I went to training camp, and I got to play this year that time, and I played well in the preseason games, and they ended up keeping me. And that's when I felt like, man, I arrived. I'm in the NBA. It was awesome.
Yeah, what's that feeling like of seeing your name on the back of your jersey when you walk in the locker room, first game of the season, and you're an NBA player?
It's funny, man. When I went to sign my contract with the Jazz. Now, this is, I don't tell many people this, but the first thing I did, I walk into the arena, and I'm by myself, and the guy who picked me from the airport, and I said, hey, just give me a second, I want to walk into the arena by myself, just kind of take it all in. And believe it or not, I reenacted the MGA, Michael Jordan, game six shot when they won a championship. And, like, I literally did that in Jazz Stadium by myself because it was just kind of cool to know that. Here I am in the place that happened. So the fact that I was signed with the Jazz was special, but it just hits you that, man, this league, here I am, I've made it. Like, I haven't signed like a multi-year deal or anything, but yeah. Yet I'm going to play a game in an NBA jersey in this arena. So it was pretty cool, man. It's something that I felt, you know, it was a dream. It was a goal that, you know, I accomplished.
I want to go through really quickly each of the countries you played in, but who is the best player you ever played against in the NBA?
That I guarded and, like, actually had to, like,
yeah,
go against, I would say probably Carmelo Anthony. I didn't really guard Kobe much. I didn't get a chance to guard him. But Carmelo Anthony, like, we went at it, and that was pretty cool, man. That's when he was really young and he was really athletic. I mean, the dude could play.
Yeah, he could score anywhere he got the ball, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, score at the mid-post, score in the post, score in the mid-range, shoot some threes some. Just an absolute scoring machine.
Mm-hmm. You got to be locked in, boy, and get a bucket easy.
Okay, I know you went to the D-League, and then you end up going overseas. One memory of playing for Teramo in Italy.
So the cool thing about Italy, you know, my first year over there, I made more money in Italy than I made in the NBA as a NBA minimum. So, you know, I was getting paid a lot of money to play there. And, you know, it was cool, man. You know, it was very competitive. The league was really good. There was a lot of NBA guys in that league. The basketball was at the highest level. And, you know, it was an opportunity for me to, you know, for my first time playing in Europe to, you know, show, hey, that I could play and hopefully sign a bigger deal. And I just remember the arenas, man, because that was the first country I played, and I played in a lot more countries after that. But I remember the arenas and the city and how much love they had for the team. It was pretty cool. It was pretty cool.
The next year you went to Jerusalem. I know you were with the Bulls in between but didn't make the final cut. What do you remember about Jerusalem?
So being a Christian, man, I mean, just living in Jerusalem was pretty cool, man. And my house was like 10 minutes away from where Jesus was, you know, crucified and buried and rose. 15, 20 minutes from Bethlehem where he was born, you know. And that was surreal, just being able to play in that environment and, you know, learn Hebrew and, you know, go to all different sites and, you know, play for Jerusalem. I mean, we had a lion on our jersey. It was like the lion of the tribe of Judah. And, you know, for a kid who grows up, you know, going to Sunday school, like the tribe of Judah is kind of cool and special. And here I am with a lion on my jersey because I'm playing for Jerusalem. So that was a moment a year that my wife and I will always remember.
Spain the next year, what was that like?
Spain was cool. That was the first time I ran into a situation where they say, hey, you know, you might not get paid. Like, the sponsor didn't have any money, and we were getting paid for the last, like, the month before Christmas. So I remember kind of leaving there because I wasn't getting paid and going to France. So, you know, the time I was in the ACB was good. Very tough league. At that time, it was very competitive. And even to this day, I think the ACB is one of the best leagues in the world, second to the NBA. So it was good. It was fun. I mean, I got to play against Joel Ingles, who's killing now, yeah. You know, and the NBA signed a major contract. I got to play against Ricky Rubio. That's when he was like 16 playing for Barcelona. And he was like the Spanish Justin Bieber. So that was cool seeing that and seeing his fanfare. But it was cool, man. Just all those countries, man. Spain, Italy, and Jerusalem, man. Just it's an experience that only basketball can provide for someone like myself. And I'm so grateful for the game to be able to live in those countries.
You mentioned you went to France. Then you were in the Bulls training camp twice for a kid from Chicago, the same kid who you had that great comeback against Arizona. You reenacted the Jordan shot. By the way, when you reenacted the Jordan shot, was it with a ball or without a ball?
Definitely without a ball.
Okay, so you made
there was even a court on. It was just like there was no court on the floor in the gym.
I got you.
But I closed my eyes and imagined it.
Okay, so, but to not make the Bulls twice, how was that? Was that devastating? What was it? I mean, or was it just wasn't meant to be because you'd already played in the league and you'd already made some money doing it? What was that like for a Chicago kid?
Shoot, man! Anytime you get cut is devastating. But that last time I thought I was going to make it, I was so close. And, you know, when you're playing well and you feel like you deserve to make the team and you don't, you know, obviously whether it's money deals or they want to go with a bet, I mean, whatever the reasoning is, you know, it is devastating. And, you know, at that time though, you know, I've been playing. So I was like, oh, it is what it is. I'm going to go overseas and, you know, sign a really good contract and, you know, maybe come back.
Yeah, but that was a really good Bulls team too, though, right? Like that team won 62 games. 62.
They did, man. Yeah. They did. And I had a great camp and had some really good games. I mean, like in preseason when I played, I mean, one of my best dunks was on Gortat. You know, my last NBA bucket was in the preseason. I dunked on Gortat. 6'6", went down the lane. Bam. I mean, it was nice. And that was my last time I scored in the NBA arena. And, so I guess I kind of went out with a bang. So I felt accomplished, I guess.
Why did you?
It didn't count though. It didn't count because it was preseason.
No, it counts.
It counted for me.
If you got Gortat, if you got a footer, you got a footer, right? Like it doesn't.
I got a footer.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. Why? So you go to Germany after that, and you play well. Why'd you walk away and start coaching?
So you know, I had ran a sports ministry in the summers. My whole playing career. And every summer I would come home and I would do skill development with these kids. I would do mentorship. And, you know, it was kind of like my heart was in that. And every year I would go back and play. Like I kind of missed, you know, that side. I missed working with kids. I missed seeing guys get better. I missed being able to be around young men and share stories and see them grow and mentor them. And like that's what I lived for. But, you know, playing basketball is what I did. You know, I was a professional athlete that paid the bills. And my last year playing, I told my wife before the season, I said, hey, if a place like Valparaiso would open up, I'll go coach college basketball there. Had no idea it was going to happen. I just knew Homer Drew. I knew Bryce. I knew kind of how they ran their program. And I had so much respect for what they did and the way they did it. I told my wife, if I was getting a coach, and I want to coach there. And the reason I said that is because my wife said, hey, you should think about coaching in college. I mean, she thought that I'd be good at it. And I was like, yeah, no, never. You're away from your family. It's cutthroat. It's a crazy business. I said, I'm going to keep playing basketball, make a lot of money, and then retire and go do ministry or do ESPN or something. And make a long story short, I mean, Homer Drew retires, Bryce gets the job, and I'm in the semifinals in Germany and competing for a championship. And he basically offers me a job during that time. And I had to make a decision once the season was done, do I keep playing? Do I sign this huge contract? I had a contract in Alba Berlin. I had some other teams in Europe trying to sign me. My agent said there were some teams in the NBA that wanted to bring me in for training camp. With all that happening, I decided to walk away and to start coaching. And that was 9 years ago. Yeah, I made that decision at 28 in my prime.
Did you have any that first year, second year? Do you have any regrets?
No, man. You know, once I started coaching, though, and you know, obviously, you know, my first year we ended up winning the Horizon League, and we went to the NIT for a mid-major at that time. Was, you know, it's a pretty good accomplishment. And my second year, we ended up, you know, winning the Horizon League regular season, and then winning the tournament and going to the NCAA tournament. And I just, we just started having success, man. And I recruited some really good players, and Alec Peters was a draft pick that was went to Valpo that I got to recruit. And I kind of fell in love with it. And funny story, though, my second year coaching, Alicante, I think Singler was playing with Alicante at the time, and he left and went to the NBA. And Alicante called my agent and asked if I'd be willing to come there and play in the middle of the season.
That's funny.
And the contract that they were going to give me was like six times more than what I was making as a college basketball coach. And my agent, Herb Rudoy, was like, hey, you want to pass this up? And that was the only time where I thought about it. I was like, man, should I leave coaching to get back into playing? And but I did, man. I was invested. I was locked in, and I'm happy that I did because, you know, shoot, my college coaching career is kind of taking off a little bit.
Well, you guys go to Vandy. You move. Of course, you land Darius Garland, who only plays a handful of games for you. So things were looking great. For people who haven't seen Darius Garland play, because he barely played for you guys at Vandy last year, what's he like?
He's a point guard. And I know it sounds very simple, but, you know, there's not many, like, real point guards out there. I mean, he is a bona fide PG with great feel, great pace, great court vision, can shoot the ball, competitive. You know, he's one of those guys in practice, he'll do something every day that you're like, wow, he really just made that pass, or he really just had that crossover, hit that step back. You're like, he really just hit that for game point. Like, the kid's special. And that's why, you know, we built everything around him, you know, and obviously we had some kids leave because they didn't think they were going to play a lot. And it was one of those things where, like, we were all in, you know, and when he got hurt, man, that was a devastating blow because, you know, our team, our system was kind of, you know, built for him to do his thing. And so I'm happy that he was still able to get drafted fifth in the NBA draft. And I think he's just going to have a tremendous career. And, you know, I hope that he can stay healthy because the kid's special.
Yeah, I was told by some Lakers guys, they worked him out. And they said it was he and Lillard are the two most impressive shooting workouts they've had for college guards. Like that he was just unbelievable. Look, you guys go 9-23. Your AD dies, so the guy who hired Bryce, you know, dies in the middle of the season. Did you have any sense that he was going to get fired?
You know, we had a feeling. You know, it was a rough. I mean, our first year there, you know, we ended up making the NCAA tournament, and you know, no one thought that we would, and you know, those guys rallied and came together, and it was a special, special moment, man. And you know, that first year, Vandy, you know, we thought after that, you know, whether we might get an extension or anything, it didn't happen. No big deal. But, you know, the second year, like, we finally ran into, like, the injury bug. Like, you know, our best player, all SEC player, goes out for the whole season in the middle and right before conference play. And, you know, we struggle, you know, with him being gone. You know, he hurt his shoulder, he couldn't play. And then we find this great class, and, you know, you think to ourselves, like, oh, man, we got this great class. We got a really good point guard. And then five games in, he goes out.
Right.
You know, and there are certain things that as a coach you just can't control. You can't control injuries, especially to your best player. And then not only that, your point guard. And, you know, it was rough, man. It was hard. It was the hardest 2 years of my life in basketball. And, you know, obviously when David Williams passes away, it just makes it even harder. And then, you know, people that you care about, because I really cared about him. He was a mentor for me. He believed in me. He actually gave me a great contract. I had some head coaching opportunities. I ended up staying. And he really took care of me and my family. So when he passed away, you know, that was a devastating blow. Uh-oh. And then we get fired. And it was by far the hardest 2 years of my life as it pertains to basketball.
I do want to ask, I without –
I want to ask you, though, about that NCAA tournament game, because it's forever. It's Northwestern's first appearance and their only win. But also, you mentioned the best SEC player got hurt. It's Matthew Fisher Davis. He was the one who fouled. He didn't know time and score. What was it really like after the game in the locker room? The kids devastated, you know? I can't imagine what how did you handle it? Who talked to him? How do you handle a situation like that?
Oh, man, you love him, man. You mean he's our player. He's our family. And you talked about, like, when you're playing 4 years, the bonds you have with those guys, you know, now as a coach, I get to have that every year, you know, with the new kids. And so he's one of ours, you know, he's in our fold, you know, and, you know, you embrace him, you know, it's a mistake. I mean, people make mistakes all the time, you know, coaches make mistakes, players make mistakes. No one wants to make a mistake. It just happens. So, you know, you love them through it, man. You know, hey, man, guys, we made a tournament. We were right there. We almost won. You know, let's come back and do it again next year. You know, keep your heads up, you know. And you're crying because you're going to miss the seniors, you know, the seniors that you won't get to practice, coach, teach, mentor, spend time with anymore. You're going to miss them. So, you know, that's what the locker room is like, you know, especially as a coach, because you're going to miss those guys. You know, you care about them. You know, you see them every day. They're like your sons, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's what it was like in the locker room. A lot of embracing, a lot of encouraging, crying, and a lot of excitement for the guys to come back and do it again.
All right, so you mentioned that you had an unbelievable contract. So you didn't have to take a job this year. You could have spent time with your family. You guys liked living in Nashville, although that might have been awkward. Donnie Daniels, longtime assistant, leaves and goes back to Utah, where he actually came from before he went to Gonzaga. So how did Mark Few approach you? How did it come to be where you're now an assistant at Gonzaga?
Well, I knew those guys for a while. I knew Tommy Lloyd. I coached his players on AIA tours, and I thought he thought that I did a really good job with his guys. And we were involved in some of those future head coaches events. The NCAA has a leadership thing, the invitation only, in Indianapolis, and him and I were invited to that, so we got to spend time together there. And, you know, we just kind of built a relationship through that. And I was recruiting a lot in international. I was doing a lot of recruiting in Europe. And we would see each other on the recruiting trails and have conversations. So that's really how I kind of got acquainted with Gonzaga, through Tommy Lloyd. And then I've met Mark Few through him a bunch of times. We've had some conversations. And, you know, when Donnie Daniels decided he was going to, you know, retire and move to, like, an off-court position somewhere, like, they had a spot. And, you know, you're right. Like, I mean, I had to look for a job. That was a part of my contract, look for a job. I didn't have to take a job. Because, like me, I had income for, you know, 3 more years. But, you know, Gonzaga was one of those places that, you know, it's special. And to be able to coach under Hall of Fame coach Mark Few, to be able to, you know, coach someone that I respect, Tommy Lloyd, you know, the relationship we built. And then even Brian Michelson, who was another assistant here, man, I mean, they do a great job. And, you know, they really felt like I fit a need for them, you know, with my energy, my youth. You know, I was associate coach at Vanderbilt, so, like, I focus on defense. So I have some things I can add defensively and help out with. And then, obviously, recruiting, you know, those are areas that, you know, I love. And so it was just a good fit. It was a great fit, man. And obviously, with Donnie Daniels being such a, you know, tenured coach and doing a really good job, I have some large shoes to fill. But he's been great, man, just embracing me and just kind of helping me through the process. So it's just a perfect fit for my family and I. And, you know, there's no way I would have let this opportunity pass up.
You mentioned your family, you have 2 kids, wife, and you are you're a tried and true Christian. But there's this, if people don't know you and they say Roger Powell Jr., basketball coach, there's, for whatever reason, and I think a lot of it is how we cover it in the media, but some of it is just people's perception. The thought is that, yeah, everybody's dirty, everybody cheats. What's the reality like for a guy who believes in doing it the right way, and how hard is it to compete at the highest level? You're in the SEC, and now you're at Gonzaga. You're trying to recruit top-level recruits. How hard is it to do it the right way?
Well, first of all, I got 3 kids. I just had one, a new one. My
That's
little
right.
Boy
I forgot.
Born.
I've seen all the pictures. That's right. My bad.
Yeah, little Gabriel was born July 9th. but yeah, no, my faith is really important to me. And, you know, I'm not perfect. I strive to be Christ-like. I strive to be a godly man every day. And, you know, I try to apply that to the way that I coach. I try to apply that to the way I live. And, you know, one thing I never want anyone to say, that my success came from cheating. I always wanted to be from hard work, from, you know, from relationships, from just being a good guy. And I never want anyone to do is say he got that done because he cheated. And so, you know, with that being said, I just don't deal with it. You know, I just do it the right way. And there are a lot of guys, believe it or not, I think that are the same. You know, you hear the guys who do things the wrong way, who cheat. And sometimes, I mean, guys, you know, I don't think guys blatantly cheat. Sometimes I think it's legitimate accidents. I mean, there's a lot of rule changes, a lot of things that come into play that, you know, they just don't know about or they forget about. So those, I mean, no one's perfect. But blatantly cheating, you know, I just don't deal with it, man. You know, and I do it the way I know, the way I was taught, the way I learned from Bryce and Homer. And obviously here in Gonzaga, they do things the right way. And, you know, that's all I know.
One thing that made Bill Self special as a coach?
Shoot, man, there was a lot, a ton. But I think he related to the players extremely well. Like, he can get the most out of guys. Like I would have ran through a wall for him, you know. And he had the confidence that made the team feel confident.
Yep.
But at the same time, he had that fire that would make guys play a lot harder. So I thought just the way that he handles his guys, I think for me, makes him special. And obviously, I mean, he knows the game. He's a mastermind. You can't just have one area and win that many Big 12 championships. You have to have a lot of different areas that you're good at. But managing players, personalities, getting the most out of guys, I think is what separated him.
Bruce Weber, same question.
Bruce was a great teacher. You know, he was able to teach the game and make it simple for us to go out and execute. He's one of the best teaching coaches that I played for. You know, and he had a really good way of relating to the guys too. But he just made it simple for us. And I think that's why he fits so well with, you know, our team, because, you know, he just broke it down. And it's funny because we played against him at Vanderbilt. I got to coach against him. And, you know, I spent a lot of time, you know, going over what they did and just, you know, their schemes, their offense and stuff. And, you know, he's a great coach.
Yeah.
He makes great adjustments in games. And, you know, I've coached against a lot of guys over the last, you know, 9 years. And he's one that stood out, you know, just kind of how, you know, he makes decisions in games and how he comes back when, you know, we run a play, we get a score, what he runs the next time down to kind of stop the momentum. It's pretty cool.
Best thing about Bryce Drew?
Bryce, man, I think Bryce is probably one of the best offensive coaches out there. He's a mastermind when it comes to getting guys in positions to do well, taking a team and totally changing set schemes to fit players' personalities and players' skills. And he does a great job of getting the most out of his guys as well. You know, he's very detail-oriented and, you know, and that's something that I've learned, you know, because, like, I kind of was more of the defensive side, mm-hmm. but just watching him over the years, you know, his play calling and just the way he teaches the game, it was fun to see. And he's a basketball encyclopedia, man. Basketball runs through his veins. I mean, Scott Drew, Homer Drew, I mean, that family knows the game of basketball. And, you know, it was just such a blessing to be able to be with him for 8 years. And even to this day, we're really close friends, man.
Last thing, you mentioned that you've been the defensive guy. When people prepare mm-hmm. for your style of defense, what is it that is unique or different from others?
You know, I think, you know, there's a lot of things that we did. I think at Vanderbilt and at Thoppo that, you know, really made teams really prepare for us. I don't want to give too much information because if someone hears about it, I don't want them to get my schemes. But, you know, we get after it. I love man-to-man defense. I love gaps. Gap defense, protecting the paint, making guys shoot contested 2-point jump shots. And then we did a really good job of, like, you know, trapping the post. You know, that was something that, you know, I think a lot of teams had to prepare for, you know, for us. And when we get turnover after turnover, you know, and those are pretty much some of our schemes that I think separate us and help us win a lot of games, especially at Valpo.
Yeah.
A lot of games.
Yeah. Well, listen.
And our first year at Vanderbilt.
Listen, the weird thing about trapping the post is, you know, like your team in Illinois, one of the first to play with very limited post play, right? And so that the idea when I played in college, we used to post double, post to post. But now, I mean, how many teams will play with two bigs? Very, very, very few. So you have to kind of change the rotations, and defense continues to evolve as the offense continues to evolve as well. Hey, I've already taken up way too much of your time. Obviously, I'm so happy you've landed at a great place, and I can't wait to hear what happens next. In the meantime, we'll watch the Zags this year, and I can't wait to hear your thoughts on your new squad as you guys start to get after it. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate you, too.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific.
My thanks to Roger Powell Jr. for joining us. And for the Gonzaga coaching staff for letting him come on, make sure you tell a friend, download, subscribe, and rate. And oh yeah, by the way, check out the Doug Gottlieb Show every day, 3 to 6 Eastern Time on Fox Sports Radio, 12 to 3 Pacific Time, also on the iHeartRadio app. We're on the Dan Patrick channel on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, or you can just download that podcast. But tell a friend, and thanks so much for listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.